Blog Talk Radio.
Paranexus Universe. This is Tug Kelly. I'm here with my co-host and good friend Grant Rubendunce. Welcome, Grant.
Hey, thank you, Doug. Good evening, everybody, and happy Friday.
And it is Friday, March 21st, about 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We've got a special guest with us tonight, Morgan Bell from the Southwest Paranormal Investigators based in Fort Myers, Florida. We're going to get to him in just a moment. We'd like to welcome all of our listeners, and hopefully more will come along as we get started with the show. We've got some interesting things to talk about tonight. As always, just before we begin, just wanted to remind everybody that we can take live call-ins. So if you have a question for Morgan as we get into it, the number is on your screen. I'll say it anyway. It's 347-945-7799. If you want to call in and ask a question, that's just super. We'd love to hear from you. There's also the chat room, so you know, feel free to ask questions in there. We'll try to monitor that as we go through this evening's program. So let's talk about Morgan Bell, Executive Manager, Science Division of Southwest Florida Paranormal Investigations in Fort Myers, Florida. We're going to be talking about his experiences and some interesting new approaches to paranormal research. Just a quick background on Morgan. He graduated from Frostburg State University in Maryland with a bachelor's degree in earth science in 2002. That includes geology, geography, natural sciences. He moved to Fort Myers in 2003, where he pursued a career in environmental consulting. His training to date involves many aspects of indoor air quality, asbestos, environmental site assessments, and materials testing. Through his professional experience, he endeavors to implement an objective and scientifically based process to paranormal investigations. So, Morgan, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
Thank you, gentlemen. Nice to see you guys this evening.
Great to have you.
Yeah, it is good to have you, Morgan. Of course, you know, we've known each other now since, last summer anyway, when we met in Clewiston, Florida, at the conference you guys had hosted, which was a good one, and got to meet a lot of nice people. But let's start off with, you know, you. What brings you to the paranormal field?
Well, I think personally, the thing that brings me to the paranormal field is the witnesses. There's just too many witnesses seeing things, too many witnesses, you know, with very compelling testimonials that, you know, there has to be something to it. I mean, whether it's paranormal or not, but there's still something people are seeing, and I'd like to help them out with that or at least help them, you know, capture that and kind of, not so much, I guess, prove it, but you know, just show the people that they're not crazy in a sense, because they really are seeing these things. So.
Yeah, unless they are crazy. But
right, exactly.
Yeah. But so you wanted to help that. You obviously have an interest. Did you have any experiences growing up or anything like that that kind of got you going?
I lived in a lot of old houses. I lived in a town called Uniontown in Maryland. It was an old colonial town, a lot of old houses, a lot of stories. I know as a kid I used to sleep with my fan on so I wouldn't hear all the noises at night, because those houses do make a lot of noises. But I think the only, and of course my parents and my grandparents had experiences at least around when I was younger, And I think, and I don't remember this, but this is the only thing that they've told me is that, you know, there used to be in one of the first houses that I lived in, I guess when it was like a year and a half, there evidently was a spirit of a older woman living in that house, or still in that house, where, and also the man that used to live in that house that we just bought it from prior to. I guess the children of these individuals had sold the house to my parents. And what happened was is a couple of things. My grandmother would always catch me in the crib talking to something. But nothing was there. You know, of course, they passed that off. But I think one or a couple of mornings is when they heard somebody downstairs rummaging around the cabinets and the door, furniture, and there was no one downstairs. And I just remember my dad telling me that I was up at the top of the stairs looking down, and they were all looking down the steps, and they just saw the rocking, you know, always see the rocking chair moving. But there was, he really still has that rocking chair. And they heard all kinds of things, and my mother went running down the stairs, you know, with her double barrel shotgun, rummaging around the house, and really didn't find anything, and found the front door wide open. And that's, and it happened actually like clockwork. It was kind of weird, sort of like a residual, where it would happen in early in the mornings and certain part of the year. And we found out that the man actually used to be a milkman or a milkman delivery. Personnel, and he would have to get up before light, and that's when the door would open by itself, even though that was locked. And so that was kind of neat that they found that out at a later date.
That's interesting.
Interesting story.
Yeah, go ahead. If you got a question, go for it all.
I was just curious, how long did that go on? Was that something that went on for a number of years?
As far as I remember, I know they only lived in the house for a short period of time, and I think they only lived in the house for about a year and a half or 2 years. I'm pretty sure. And as far as I can tell, it happened constantly up until they moved out. It wasn't like, you know, every day they would see something, but it was every now and then at a certain time in the morning that it would happen. And it would happen frequently, you know, kind of like a pattern to it. So.
Had to get up and go milk the cows again, huh?
And, yeah, I guess so, or deliver them up. <wherever it is. laughs> So he was still working, even in death, I guess. So,
You think that was a residual, or do you think it was an intelligent haunting?
From now that I look back at it, because of, you know, I've been in the field for a little bit, I look back, you know, but then, you know, you thought ghost is all one thing. Well, now you know that it's not true. It's a bunch of things, but that it could be. But now that I look at it, I really think that it was a residual, because it was always the same thing. It was never any reaction, and very little actual movement of objects. I mean, you would hear things, but you would never, I don't think they have ever seen anything actually move. But they would hear somebody walking around downstairs, and lo and behold, you know, the door would be open, or they would come down the stairs in the morning before the sun came up. My father was in the military, so he had to get up really early. And, you know, he noticed that on a few occasions. So, and he was the first one up, so he would know.
What's interesting to me is the fact that the door would open, you know, and it's interesting. I don't know, you know, does a residual open doors? Can a residual open doors?
Right, and that's a good question. And the only reason why I stuck it with the residual background is because it always was the same thing, and it always happened the same way. It wasn't like, you know, you would go downstairs and somebody would react with the person down there, or react to something that you would say. I mean, of course, we didn't do an investigation of the place. I'm just going by the stories that I heard.
Oh, it sounds like a residual from what you described.
Yeah.
So what brought you to Florida? You just like the weather, or?
Well, my girlfriend, really. But, yeah, I guess I like the weather. It was funny when I was a kid, you know, that question, like in middle school or elementary school, they say, if you were ever to pick a state in the U.S., where would you like to live? And for some reason, I didn't even know anything about Florida, but I'd always say Florida. And I guess because, you know, I thought it was a bunch of beaches and sand and, you know, pretty girls. but, you know, it's a lot more than that, I found. But, yeah, it just kind of happened down here.
And Morgan, I had a question. You know, your background and your education in earth science and physical science, how do you think that's influenced you as an investigator beyond the point of approaching it from an empirical standpoint?
Yeah, it's kind of it tells me that there's a lot of process to investigate. Not, you know, the empirical part that you mentioned, but mostly that, you know, you should really think things through before coming up with a conclusion, because I found in the laboratory, or, you know, just doing the simple chemistry labs, that you never know really, even though you have it on paper where you think it is, or if you have a belief, it really never ends up exactly the way that you thought the experiment or the event would occur. So there's always a lot of thought process into concluding an event, and you got to make sure you cover all your bases. You can't just go in and, you know, I mean, just setting up equipment alone is not enough. I mean, you have to do, you know, the background checks, the historical research. I mean, it's just, I think that my background kind of gave me a sense that there's a lot of thought. You should put a lot of thought into what you do before you conclude about something.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I respect about you and your group is the fact that you approach it in such a scientific manner. And, you know, maybe you could tell our audience a little bit about how, when you're setting up an investigation, what do you think are the most important, like if you were talking in our audience or some members of our audience were interested in starting their own group or starting and doing an investigation, what do you think are the foremost things that a person needs to do when they're getting set up and you know, let's assume we've gone beyond the interview stage with the client and we're really going to do an investigation. So at that point, what do you think are the most important things?
Well, doing a standard 8-hour setup or 6-hour, depending on how long you're going to be there, you know, it's always good to you know, make sure that, you know, you're testing the areas, or you're setting up the camera equipment, or you're setting up any of the monitoring devices in the areas that are really known to have the activity. I mean, there is the other approach where people don't want to know what's going on and they want to go in blind, which is fine. But then again, you want to be able to target or at least test something. So you got to know your areas in the house. Or building where you're going to be actually setting up these monitoring equipment. The other part is the most important part, I can't stress enough, is note-taking. I've seen a lot of groups where they haven't taken notes. They'll take a picture and you'll see like a leg hanging out, and they could have sworn there was no one in front of that camera, but then at the same time they can't remember how many people were with them when they were doing the walkthrough. So it was kind of, you know, that's probably one of the most important things, is taking the notes. So you have, okay, yeah, look, this is when I took these pictures. So this is, you know, there's Sally, John, and Lisa was doing the walkthrough. So those were the only three, and they were pretty close to each other. Oh, look, here's Sally's video of that night. You can tell that there was no one up front in front of them. This must be a Gen 1 photo. So, you know, at least it's something there that can really help out with controlling the evidence afterward. So you know what's going on.
I couldn't agree with you anymore in terms of the importance of documentation. As a routine, when you set up, do you bring in any of your staff members to do baseline, you know, EMF readings and temperature readings, sweeps, those sort of things?
Absolutely.
But for somebody who's new, why do you feel that's important?
Well, a lot of that, of course, with EMF, you know, can be caused by a lot of natural causes, like alarm clocks, electrical systems, and other issues like that. But then the temperatures is also dealing with HVAC systems. You know, how often does it kick on? What temperatures it set at? Do you want to shut it off prior to an investigation? And a lot of times you do. So there's a lot of factors. You know, I take a few people, and I have a guy on our team that's actually a plant operator at a local high school. So, you know, that's usually one of the best people to bring right in the beginning, so, or during the prelim, to where they can really look at the place and find out any you know, artifacts of natural causes, like noises from plumbing, from bad HVAC leaking, smells, you know, stuff like that. Usually they're accustomed to dealing with in their professional career. So, yeah, I think that's probably the reason to do that kind of stuff, is to make sure that when you go in to do one of those controlled walkthroughs, that you know all the areas where there may be some sort of anomaly that can be explained.
absolutely, you're ruling out any natural or any, you know, things that would be man-related to refrigerators, air conditionings, those sort of things. And of course, the importance of the baseline reading is so that you've got a comparison when you complete your investigation.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, a lot of that seems very complex, and people tend to, a lot, there's that opinion out there that kind of gets in the way of experiencing the paranormal. But once you get used to it, really, it becomes second thought, and your process just runs right through, and you don't even notice that you're doing all that stuff. And then you can really concentrate on observing, which is one of the most important parts of investigating.
Absolutely.
So tell us some of the important, some more important things, Morgan, that you feel, mm-hmm. that your approach, why is it your approach? What is it
right.
you do?
Well, I wouldn't coin it, but I do think that it's a unique approach in the field where our team is starting to build a full case of unmanned monitoring equipment. What I mean by that is small, DVRs that fit into cases, lockable cases and stuff that we can actually leave on the premises for several months to monitor a situation. There's Asian Wolf. If you go to AsianWolf.com, they have these many DVRs that actually are, you know, typical 30 frames per second, two camera systems. And they work just like a normal DVR, but they're substantially cheaper and they fit in small cases. So you can literally get, like a Pelican case and actually drill a few holes and make it so that you can lock it and have it turned on. So when something does happen, that client can say, it happened again. What do I do? And you just give them the instructions, just unplug the system and leave it there and we'll come and pick it up. There's another setup that we use, which are data loggers made by a company called Lasker Electronics. They also have a bunch of these small USB temperature and humidity data loggers that actually log, depending on how long you want to set it up for. They can set up to data log for 82 days, up to 3 months. Even longer than that even. And that's really neat because you can actually take that data, plug it right into your computer, and it pops up right there and it tells you the time, dates, and everything where those data points are. And, you know, if somebody had an experience and you had this thing set up on their end table next to their bed where they usually, you know, experience these things, you can see if there's actually a correlation between temperature and humidity changes and the activity that's occurring. Because you always hear about, oh, if it's getting cold, I can see my breath. Well, if he can see their breath and it's getting cold in that room, then there's an obvious change in temperature, and usually with temperature, there's a direct effect on humidity and vice versa. You know, any change in humidity, there's going to be a change in temperature. So you'd be able to actually see that, and it'd be tangible evidence right there in your hands that, look, there's something going on here. This person experienced this. The data logger actually, you know, recorded this event, with a temperature change. And so, you know, it's a good way to actually, show people, like, you know, instead of saying, I felt cold, which is actually a qualitative type of data, it's an observative, where you have an actual quantitative, you have something that you can work with and hopefully come up with some more theories to test later. So.
Well, one is subjective versus objective.
Yes.
If they feel cold, that's subjective, but if you log that, and I assume that you have the clients with a log book or logging those instances as well.
Yeah, and that's another challenge too. Getting people to actually write, diaries or logs about this kind of stuff. We usually always bring in a composition book for them, and that's like an always. We always do that, but a lot of times you get people, well, I don't write notes very well, or I don't really want to write it. And I said, well, it's something that you would really need for these people to, you know, if they're really having an experience and they really want to be able to explain it. They need to start, taking it serious by writing the notes or keeping a journal of some sort.
Well, it's the least they can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, cool. So let's go back to the remote DVR or the portable DVR. Is that, what are you calling it?
It's a good thing. We're going to come up probably with a name for the system once we get it built. We're going to be building a few of them. Yeah, like
Morgan's Box.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a good idea. No, but we'll come up with something catchy, I guess. But, yeah, it's actually really inexpensive. I think the cases actually, in some cases, cost more than the DVR themselves.
Wow.
These things cost around $200, standalone units.
Really?
And, yeah, and the only thing you have to buy are the cable and the two cameras. And sometimes you just want to leave one camera on the system because then it actually will allow to have much higher quality on that video.
Sure.
Yeah, because they split. Every time you put a camera on the system, it splits. And these take 2 gigahertz SD cards, which you can record probably up to 18 to 20 hours. And you can also eventually, and we were talking with the manufacturer, they're coming up with a new version where you can actually hook it up to an external hard drive. So there's a few neat innovations that the company's coming out with, and they primarily use these for surveillance and spy surveillance. But for our use, it's very, very unique and a great tool.
That's very good. That's very interesting. Any questions, Grant? Did we lose Grant? Must have lost him.
We made it.
Oh, cool. Then I always have a question. Can you tell me the meaning of life? Okay, that's not
that
real. let's go into meditative or vegetative state for that one.
Yeah.
All right, so...
the crickets talk.
So how long have you been with Southwest Florida Paranormal Investigations then?
I've been with them for about 5 years. They've been around since around 2000, a little bit before that, and a smaller group of friends. Myself, I've been involved with them for about five. I've been doing this kind of follow-up of investigating for about almost 10 years.
Cool.
So it's kind of interesting, because of the education that I have and because of the background, it actually made me more susceptible to actually going out and testing all this stuff that's going on. I have new ideas and all kinds of new approaches that I have coming up. As far as doing the unmanned investigating, there's a lot of different things that these DVRs and other systems can actually do.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if the house has a network connection, you can actually hook it up and connect to it via the internet and actually record it onto your laptop or hard drive via your home. And a lot of that will allow us to help clients, especially if they go on vacations for long periods of time. We can leave those types of equipment in a house that's locked up, and we'll be able to see if there's anything going on. So.
Yeah, I have to tell Yari about that because he's got a location. Yari Mikola, my friend and colleague in Paranexus, he's in Denver, and he's got a house that he wants to do an ongoing investigation. There's some stuff going on there, and he'd want to know about that. So, okay, so go ahead.
No, yeah, as I was going to say, doing those types of investigations, there's plenty of equipment out there that can be used, like weather stations, remote weather stations that are actually connect to the internet. You'll be able to monitor humidity and temperature in different rooms. There's a plenty of a plethora of type of equipment, even the wildlife cameras.
Which is another
thing. I think Cuddleback is probably one of the best manufacturers, but they're the most expensive, of course. But
Amtrak.
Yeah,
they're getting that popular.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, they sure are. I saw those on for the first time on TV. Obviously the ghost hunters used them, but I've been using them for about 5 years. I guess since I started, I actually went out and just bought one from Walmart and see how well it works, but it's a low end, so it's not as sensitive. But yeah, they seem to be one of the newer toys to be used, but there's kind of a divide with them, and that's dealing with the actual motion detection. In a lot of cases where something was seen or was captured on video or something didn't actually set off the motion detection. Even houses and large banks and facilities like historical sites that have motion sensing lights and stuff aren't ever set off by these ghosts. So sometimes they are in some places. I mean, there's been cases where motion detectors have been set off. So
have you got? this is the cam trap you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you guys use motion detectors, you know, with alarms at all?
Yeah, actually, you can actually set those up with the DVR systems as alarms for the camera system to turn on.
How does that work for you? I mean, do you find anything trips it?
Not a whole lot, really, trips it. I mean, I guess in a house or a location specifically dealing with poltergeist-type activity, that's where it would probably be the most useful because you have an actual physical object moving around. But as far as, you know, apparitions and stuff, that's still up in the air because no one's really been able to capture an apparition, well, let alone with a normal camera.
Yeah.
But with a motion detection, and a lot of times people have observed during investigations that they actually saw somebody walk down the hallway, but the motion sensor never set it off. So, like I said, ghosts, if you put them all in one pot, it's really not that accurate. It's probably a huge amount of different types of phenomenon that we're looking at, and some of it does certain things and some of it does others. So.
You know, the thing that's really interesting about it is when you're talking about those cameras, and I want to let you guys know, for some reason I was cast out into the ether a little bit ago, and I've just been drawn back in, so I wasn't ignoring what you fellas were saying. The thing that's interesting, and I was so glad that you said that, Morgan, was because if you recall several years ago, over in Great Britain or the UK, they had photographed some really interesting stuff on the surveillance cameras.
Yes.
And I believe it was around one of the royal, or you know, where the, if not the the royal family had lived, somebody's along those lines. And they were very interesting photographs. And I just, it might have even been Ghost Hunters that recently came up with some interesting ways to debunk that, which I thought I thought at the beginning they're very interesting, intriguing.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. It could be especially with some of these camera systems, they're very low quality. If you can recall the gas station ghost that was all over the news and YouTube recently, where you see this big blue blob on the front. You know, and the general public, for one thing, will see that and say, oh, my gosh, it can only be one thing. It's a ghost. But when I looked at it, you know, it was something that I'm used to seeing, particularly, especially when you're doing an outside investigation, when you get a little bug right on the lens because of that light, or if you have a light that's near it, it will turn like a light bluish greenish color because of the IR. And the IRs are on at that gas station, even though that the lights were on. And so you'll get that kind of hue. And it, you know, this, and like in London, like you were saying, this cameras could be picking up all kinds of things that may be moving in the foreground or the background. So it's best to try to get the best quality image possible in those systems. And like I was saying, the Cuddleback, which you can buy at like Bass Pro Shops, are probably around $400 at the cheapest, and but you know it's one of those deals where, you know, if you have the money, I'd spend it on that. So.
Well, cool. Well, listen, we're coming down to the bottom of the hour now. We've been talking with Morgan Bell of Southwest Florida Paranormal Investigations in Fort Myers, Florida. Actually, Morgan, you're not in Fort Myers, are you?
Well, no, we're not right now. I'm in the Bahamas working on a job site. So.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. All right, so we're talking about some different approaches to paranormal research. We've got some more stuff coming up. We want to talk about short-term versus long-term investigations a little bit more, the pros and cons and so forth. Plus, we'll continue to talk about equipment. We're going to take a break here just a second. Before we do, just like to remind our listeners that we do have the chat room if you're not in it. And we also have the ability for you to call in and ask questions. The number is on our profile page there. It's 347-945-7799, and we'd love to take your call-ins, or if you've got a question, you can also post it in chat, and we'll try to keep our eyes on that as well. When we come back, more of Morgan and more of Grant and probably more of me too, huh?
Why not?
Sounds good.
Yeah. More of the Doug. One more.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, I know it. All right, so... Folks, thanks for hanging in there with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Back. This is Doug Kelly with my co-host Grant Reuben Dunst. Say hey, Grant. Did I lose Grant again?
Shut him down.
Wow, we were just talking too. All right,
we were.
So, we'll get Grant back.
I think he's coming back on right now.
No, he's had some some internet issues. Yeah, we dropped Grant. I'll get him back. Anyway, we were talking about some equipment. We've been talking about that in the first segment, and you've got something else that is interesting. You want to talk about that? Tell us what it is. Looks like we've lost Morgan too. All right, folks, give me a couple of minutes. Let me get our guest back and Grant back. I don't know what's quite going on with everybody, but hang tough with me, and I'll be right back. Okay, folks, we are back. Second. All right, we're back. We've got Morgan back. We've lost both everybody, and we're still trying to get Grant back. But Morgan, we were talking about some equipment that was interesting. You want to talk about that? Tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm sure my group has heard this many times. They're, you know, the geek Morgan is talking about the cameras again. But this is the SMPD chip made by a company out of South Korea called Planet 82. It's one of the most recently developed technologies. It applies nanomaterials resulting from a quantum effect, and this is directly from them, a quantum effect into the unit pixels of the photo detection area in order to realize highly sensitive images. The nanostructural photo detector functions as a multi-carrier using the quantum effect as a single electron. So it's actually a sensor, like an image sensor that you would have in, a digital camera,
mm-hmm.
a digital video camera, a CCTV, TV camera, like a security camera, even cameras that are installed in cars now, stuff like that. It's basically a sensor that can sense up to the size of an electron because it's using like a nanotubes to as a sensor collection device. And it's one of the first of its kind, and probably one of the first of its kind nanotechnology being used in some sort of sensory chip or computer chip. And they have them built. I think right now they're just in the process of having a mass production that's being planned. And I've seen them in use. You can look online in a bunch of locations. PC Magazine has articles on it. There's a lot of other places on the net. If you just Google Planet 82, and it's all one word, just Planet 82, or SMPD chip, you'll see a bunch of articles on it. And I've seen it being demonstrated at the CES and a few other conventions this year, where it's just astounding. It can basically function in zero lux. It's supposed to replace all night vision probably in the future here for the military. It's better than night vision that they have
right
now, and it actually can sense in the many different spectrums, including the infrared spectrum. So it doesn't emit any light like an infrared camera does now, like your typical setup. Right. So this actually absorbs all light. It does not emit any light, and I think that's going to be a big plus for us because the type of phenomenon that we're dealing with is very subtle, and flooding it even with infrared, people don't realize that literally they have a spotlight out there that just our eyes can't see. And what's going on is you're flooding that area with photons, whether it's infrared or not, and that may have an effect on actually being able to see some of this stuff. And I think a lot of people overlook that because, oh, I can't see the infrared light, therefore it's dark in this room. Well, not in the infrared spectrum.
Uh-huh.
It's actually light up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
So, what these cameras will probably end up doing is absorbing light, everything that's being fluctuated, changed in any way whatsoever. You'll be able to see it. And so if there is this type of phenomenon that is occurring, this new sensory chip will really do a splendor, hopefully, once it starts coming up. So I think they keep announcing every year that they're going to have it in products, but right now they're shooting for next year, and the first products that it's going to be in is probably still cameras or photography and security cameras, which is good for us because they're going to be the first things that they're actually going to put them in.
That's very interesting.
Hey, guys.
Grant back. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I must have been playing with a Ouija board or something tonight. I don't know. I just fell into a vortex, fellas. So I hope you guys in the audience will forgive me.
Well, we've got a call. Gregory has called in. Let's take his call and see what he's got going on. Hey, Gregory, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
Hey, Doug, Grant, Morgan, how are you all doing?
Hey,
good, Gregory.
Morgan, I always want to know about psychics and sensitives. How do you use them on your team?
Psychic and sensitives, yeah. Officially, we don't use them as a means to conclusions. There are a few investigators on our team that consider themselves sensitive, but their approach is the same, where they don't really assume that they know everything that's going on in the environment, but they do sense some things that they don't quite understand. And I think both of them, the two that I know of, their sense of, you know, being psychic or sensitive is kind of, you know, like a humbling, what am I looking for, like a, not, I wouldn't say ignorance, but they just, they don't take it to the point where they think that they know exactly what they're seeing. They just know that they're seeing something, and that they kind of gear their investigation towards setting up equipment, using it sort of like a tool to try to collect evidence. And, you know, if they know of a name or something that ever comes up, of course, you know, it wouldn't hurt that to use that information during an EVP session. But as far as, you know, let's say we're done an investigation and we go to the client and conclude or write up a report, we don't say, well, because the psychic said, it must be so. And we really try to avoid any, you know, human error aspects of the investigation when we conclude. And that includes Ouija boards and, you know, dowsing rods and stuff like that, because we don't, it's not that we don't believe in it and that it's bad or anything like that. And some people may in our group, but the purpose for not using that type of stuff is mainly to avoid as much human error as possible. And it, so it's not so much the psychics leading, you know, the investigators around it. It's more or less we're all, each team has the leader, and they pretty much run it typically the same way every time. And we shy away from actually sending in a psychic to feel out the area and get names and, you know, make conclusions about a location and then tell the client, because even the people that are in our group that really do see a lot of this, that type of stuff admit that they don't really understand it, and it's not always clear. And and it's kind of a good approach, because really not a whole lot is known about that type of ability, so to speak. It's really hard to prove it, and it's very hard to actually test it, you know, empirically or with evidence. So it's really hard to do that.
Do you have a follow-up question, Gregory?
Well, I was wondering if there would ever be a time where you thought maybe psychic mediums would play a significant role in any sort of scientific method of testing them. So they could be...
I'm sorry, what was that last part?
So they could be more beneficial toward a paranormal investigation.
Right, right. Yeah, actually, you know, for the longest time, probably since the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of scientific research into people that are supposedly sensitive or psychic. That kind of thing's been done for quite a while. And in fact, you know, even today, when especially when we do joint investigations with groups that do use psychics, we do set up a few experiments with them, particularly with history. It's kind of hard to, you know, send a psychic in and not, you know, you have to be very trusting of them that they didn't do this huge research in the background and then they start spitting out the names that they read on a book. But, you know, it's good to bring in a control. And like we did at the, for fun there at the Clewiston Inn last year, you know, I knew a bunch of the guys that were sensitive from your organization, you know, claimed that they did not read anything on the sites or know anything about the location. And they were actually, a few of them were actually pretty close about some of the history that's been talked about there. And it was pretty impressive. And it may be true. And I'm not saying that, you know, psychics aren't telling the truth or aren't real. It's just that there is an incredible amount of human error involved. And we just try to avoid that just so we can capture the evidence, you know, as objectively as possible.
Well, if nothing else, certainly bring a little fun to the investigation, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of that aspect to it. I think our group is, and it's not a bad or good thing, you know, depending on how your group is run, ours is trying to be as straightforward and professional, and, you know, it's great to have fun. I mean, you have to, or you're going to go daddy doing this stuff. But at the same time, when we're doing a serious case, we try to stick to our guns and not change our procedure.
Any other questions, Gregor?
No, that's it for now. Thanks.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
You bet.
All right. I know if Gregory said something. Did you say something, Gregory? No? Okay.
Yep, he's gone.
Yeah, we're gone. He's gone. So, okay. So as far as the what you're talking about, Morgan, the scientific approach, you know, there's different flavors of that as well. And,
yes.
And we of course, do use psychics and so forth, sensitives on our teams. But I will tell you that what you stated is obviously a concern. You have to make sure that the people that you've got with you are trustworthy, are validated. That's what I like to do, is validate them, you know,
right.
See where they're at. And now, and we all know, even they know, that they're never 100%, but we use them as again, for their gifts to help as a tool, and they know that.
Oh, sure. Sure. And it's the same thing in our group. It's just, it's more or less, there. We try to not, like, for instance, a perfect example is, you go into a location and you have non-psychics or science people that are there, or just regular investigators, and then you send a psychic in there with them as well. And then the psychic starts saying things, and well, then those people will start playing off of them and saying, oh, really? Okay, what's the name? And then they'll get totally distracted by this person coming up with a bunch of names, and then they're saying, oh, I'm not sure. And then they just did a whole hour where they're, you know, chasing a psychic around.
That never happens to us, Grant, right?
But not that I can ever recall,
yeah.
Doug. Never. But, you know, one of the questions I really wanted to ask you tonight, when
sure.
I haven't been cast out here in the
yeah.
reaches of the netherworld, is with your scientific background and your training, how much of this do you think we might be able to attribute to geomagnetic activity, underground water, mineral
yeah.
deposits? How
right.
much of that do you think might really be contributing to this whole phenomenon in your own mind, Mark?
Right, in my own mind, I mean, I've heard the geological connections. I mean, I believe more so the plate tectonic type activity, where you do actually have high electric fields generated by the pressure between two plates. But as far as, you know, I've heard the limestone deposit theory, where, you know, like especially from Taps and other people have said, you know, it's the limestone deposit. Well, there must, you know, we've been noticing a pattern. Well, the problem is with that is that a large, vast percentage of geological structure has a form of limestone somewhere in it, because, you know, the geological history of our area specifically used to be a shallow sea.
Yeah,
so,
we'd be racing ghosts
right.
to the grocery store down here if that was the
exactly,
case.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, I'm really careful about, you know, making those conclusions, because it's not impossible to prove, but a lot of assuming is occurring with that, as far as trying to attribute that, because I've seen activity or heard about activity in areas where there really is no limestone, because it's been washed away. If you think about it, the Catoctin Mountains, it's all granite, inorganic rock, and there's still activity up there. You know, and you, same thing along the Piedmont areas and stuff, where there is shale and there is limestone. The thing with there's a theory here in Florida, is because of the area is a karst location, meaning there's a lot of underground waterways and systems creating pressure and energy.
Yeah,
and the aquifer is correct. And, you know, again, there's if you go to Puerto Rico, that place is, the entire island is an aquifer. So it's kind of, you know, how do you prove that, and have you been able to attribute that? It really is across the board. Paranormal activity, dealing with specifically with ghosts, it's very random, and it's pretty much wherever people have lived or died. And that's as far as I've gotten, as far as making a conclusion on that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you know, the one thing that's always kind of fascinated me is, when you think of it, even if the magnitudes of the fields that we're constantly surrounded by, you know, like geomagnetic and the natural radiation that's coming in that we're being bombarded with all around, I've often wondered if some of this might be attributed to the interaction of all those things that are going on around us, and if those electrical activities, whether they're geomagnetic or caused by atmospheric conditions, if they're in the right conditions, if some of these anomalies, not all, but
right.
some of them might be attributed to natural activities.
Oh,
that,
sure.
You know, are a combination of that.
Right, and you know, there's a big theory now going on with sunspots and dealing with that type of energy field coming from the sun when we get solar storms and such, where, you know, it really does have an effect electromagnetically on devices, radios, and other issues, satellites, even, you know, all the way down to the ground. You know, you have a lot of effects, even the static effect that people have actually witnessed along highways where they have high tension wires, where they'll actually see arcing occurring because of these sunspots. And you know, recently, especially some of the scientists that are directly involved in studying that activity have said that in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, that there's been a huge increase, an unnatural increase in solar storms, and that, you know, a lot of that could be occurring where we're starting to see a lot more activity in the
area. Right, and I think if I recall, it's usually cyclical in nature. And what's
right.
going on now is, as some people are going so far as to try to tie it in with, like, we're going into a new phase, and there's
right.
most definitely changes in the Earth's atmosphere were impacted, and they're trying to tie it in with the 2012 gloom and doom disaster scenario.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, it could be all that, and that's why I've always paid attention to those solar storm reports on spaceweather.com.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when we're going out, you know, there's not much we can do about planning and investigation, but when we're going out, if there's a solar storm, I'm going to note it and see it. And each time I do that, I can go back and find out to see EVPs that were captured, if they weren't or if they were, you know. And it's kind of one of those things, like if there's a large solar storm being reported, you know, I try to get some of our team out to known locations, public locations where we can access and just do some EVP sweeps and to see what we can capture, if there's a difference between the days that are, you know, high storm activity or low storm activity.
Well, good. We had mentioned we were going to talk about long-term versus short-term investigations,
yes.
pluses and negatives. You want to We've got about 5 or so minutes before the break. What do you got on that?
Yeah, the short-term investigations are, you know, your typical 8 or overnight investigation. As you guys know, with your experience, that it's not always adequate enough just to go out one night and call it a day.
Right.
Because, you know, it's like hitting a needle in a haystack. If you go to the place at the right time, you know, you get it. But sometimes you won't. You know, it's just one of those things. So short-term is somewhat good for, you know, being there for a sustained longer period of time at one time period, like an 8-hour, 12-hour period. But long-term is definitely a lot more beneficial because you can set up equipment, you can visit, you can continue to interact with the clients and the homeowners, where they'll become a lot more attuned to observing and taking notes themselves as well, getting them involved. But at the same time, still conducting the short-term investigations when you can. But long-term is definitely a lot more feasible as far as capturing evidence and actually figuring out what's going on in a location. So every time we go out, we always mention to the people, you know, it's not like television. We would really like to have access, you know, periodically, and not, you know, every day where we're, you know, sitting in their living room with our kids every Saturday morning eating Cheerios, but, you know, having somewhat of access to that location so we can help them out in a better, more thorough sense.
That makes a lot of sense, because what you said about that, hitting a needle in a haystack, is often true. You know, you've got to, and certainly with some investigations, they warrant that type of a deal.
Sure.
So,
and you know, and also a lot of times it's locations aren't in need of that total flood of equipment and technology everywhere, you know, cams being set up.
Right.
It, sometimes that can actually be a little bit overkill, and I've seen that occur in a lot of other investigations that I've been on where, you know, it's just totally overkill, and you have little time to actually observe and measure things around you.
Well, let's switch gears here for a second before the break. Morgan, why don't you tell us about your website, how people can visit that, and then you guys have a conference coming up in St. Petersburg, Florida. So go ahead.
Yeah, our website is swftionline.com. Our MySpace is just MySpace/SWFPI. site is real easy to navigate. Purpose of the site is just to show, you know, some of the stories and investigations that we've done. So we have a lot of videos, a lot of mini documentaries on there. We do have an event coming up that we did last year called the Florida Ghost Gathering. You can also find that information on our website and on our MySpace. Typically, it's for investigative organizations in Florida only, usually with at least a year experience with an online presence. But that's just to verify. But yeah, it's a neat event that we've just started up. It's kind of we're working together with other groups on the event. It's not just us, SWFPI only. It's literally working, and it's up to the other groups in Florida to really make it into something special. And a lot of them have. This year, we're working with Spirits of St. Pete out of St. Petersburg on a location called the Heritage Inn or Heritage Hotel, an old historical location. And we're right now in the process of investigating it, getting all the historical information along with Spirits of St. Pete, and really getting a good layout of information on that location before we have this get together. And the get together is really for everybody to network. We have speakers from each group, one or two speakers from each group, in their own specialities. And we kind of, it's a good networking. It's a good time to get together, share ideas, debate, argue. I mean, that's what it's all about. So,
we didn't do arguing last time.
I know, we didn't do too much. I mean, we I tried to get people started with the orb stuff, but no one was really disagreeing. I couldn't get anybody on the other side saying, you're wrong, I wanted that. But
maybe we can talk about orbs.
We'll plant some hecklers the next time.
Yeah, there you go.
But, the thing of it is, you give folks a wonderful opportunity in a forum to bring, and one of the things I appreciate so much about Southwest is your professional approach. And you guys did a wonderful job in Clewiston, and were the ultimate host, and I would certainly encourage all groups throughout Florida, that meet the criteria that Morgan just talked about, to come and participate, meet, interface with us, share information. That's what we're all about.
Exactly. And, what I really was trying to do, the whole mission was obviously to bring Florida paranormal investigative groups together. But, I've noticed for a long time that there's been these barriers between groups and, hearsay and finger pointing. But when people actually get to meet each other and really talk, they find out, well, yeah, I might disagree with him completely, but hey, he's a nice guy. And we're really working, and we have actually good theories that we're sharing with each other. And it's kind of, that's what I want to bring to the community rather than these walls that are being put up artificially when they really shouldn't be there.
Right.
That's one of the beauties of it. And as you well know, Morgan, Spirit Team embraces that as well, because we want to, provide a forum for everybody.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. And it.
All right. We can talk more about that. And we got still an hour left, so we've got some other topics we're going to address. Not to exclude the orb thing, we won't beat it to death, but we'll talk about it. Plus some other different things that we've got on the agenda. So, listeners, thanks so much for hanging with us. We'll be back in just a moment right after the break.
But I'd show the ever after, many years before the twilight. So young, vibrant, so charmed by life, keeping the vultures at bay. She had everything going for her till the day she met me. Still you look so innocent, you don't understand. Open doors and mirrors on my desert. Feel the blood burning in my veins. In the back of your mind, you know what I mean. Stood close, ready to complete the masterpiece. Stones, fools, and mama, you didn't fear. Still you look so innocent. Don't understand. Open doors and mirrors on my desert. Feel the blood burning in my veins. In the back of your mind, you know what I mean. Another page of my little black book. One-way streets have come and gone, and the lonely alleys don't take long. Stores and booze has gotten down on the horse and pushes on this side of town. Streetlights out and dusk is here. Swimming mama, you need to hear. Still you look so innocent. Don't understand. Open doors and mirrors on my desert. Feel the blood burning in my veins. In the back of your mind, you know what I.
Welcome back to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, and I'm here with Morgan Bell. Welcome back, Morgan.
Hey, how you doing?
And we have lost our co-host, Grant, once more. He's apparently there's something going on up there. They're having some internet issues going on in Bradenton. So let's continue our discussion, Morgan, and I'll try to get Grant back here as he has a chance to get back rebooted or whatever he's doing. Morgan, let me ask you this. Okay, new groups starting out.
Right.
What advice would you give to new groups just starting out? Maybe they really haven't been on an investigation, or they've maybe done some cemeteries or some light investigations. What would you offer them as far as advice?
Well, there's two typical types of investigations. You have, you know, your public or cemetery where they don't really have to deal with clients, and then the ones that they do have to deal with clients. And I think telling them that to have a real solid plan on how to professionally deal with a client is probably one of the most important parts of investigating at a home and dealing with the clients. Knowing the different types of issues with psychology and letting people feel comfortable, especially when you ask them questions, because they might download the you know, they're the typical questionnaire for a paranormal investigator. And, you know, on that, I've seen on that almost all the sheets, you have these specific questions. They're like, are you on medication? Are you,
right.
you have a mental illness? You know, those are the kinds of things you don't just ask somebody.
Are you a whack job?
Yeah, exactly. That's something that you probably would have them fill out at a later date. But, you know, you got to know how to deal with people. First off, when you get into this, and I think that's if you have somebody in your organization that's very experienced in interviewing or at least talking with people on a daily basis, I think that's probably one of the most important things for doing an investigation of a private home or even a business.
People skills is what you're talking
about. Yeah, exactly. People skills. I've witnessed, you know, a few new groups where they've gone out and they really weren't used to that, and it kind of was, you know, kind of uneasy for the client.
Right.
And you don't want to put the client in any unease because if they're really truly having a real experience, then, you know, they're already uneasy to begin with. So.
Yeah, so you don't want them saying, the point here for anybody just starting into the area of paranormal research, be aware of what you say, be careful of what you say, and make sure that your team members are careful about what they say. You don't want to say, oh,
right.
Yeah, I just saw this shadow thing, you know, pass by me in the hallway, and
oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot of things like don't, you know, you shouldn't really review your evidence in front of the people. You know, say, oh, I think I have an EVP. Here, you want to listen? And you know, that kind of thing can really crash sometimes during an investigation, and sometimes can really, if the client's hysterical to begin with, it'll really make him, you know, go off the wall, and you don't want that to happen during an investigation. You want to at least you want to be there to help the people, to you know, because you know to share with the people that, you know, statistically, really no one's died because of a ghost, and they're probably not going to get, you know, hospitalized either, unless they scare themselves into a wall or something like that. So,
one of the things we believe in the group that we've kind of borrowed from the medical and the psychological community, and I know that you guys do at Southwest, is the premise that we do no harm.
Exactly.
Any of our clients.
Right. You want to go in there and you want to leave that location the way that you came into it. At least, you know, you don't want to set you know, alarms off when you leave and to say your place is haunted, it's got demons, we're out of here. You know, that's not. And I had a friend that has a group up north that's had that happen, where they've gone in after another group that, you know, caught some red orbs in a laundry room, and they said that they're red and they're a certain type of demon, and that they all rushed out and left, and we can't handle this case. So they were all distraught, and so they ended up calling this other group, and they came in and said, yeah, we caught some red orbs too, and they took out the lint cage and, you know, showed, lo and behold, they must have been drying, you know, some red linens. So it's you know, a lot of times the smallest thing can set off things that really aren't necessary.
So, okay, so people skills, very important for newer groups and, for frankly, for some many existing groups I've come
across.
So people skills, I'm with you. A number one most important thing that you can have to be successful in anything you do in life, hands down.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So what else? What other tips, techniques, tools, things like that, aside from what we've discussed, would you recommend for a newer group? Let's talk about equipment. You got a newer group, you know, limited budget. What would you recommend?
Sure. Your typical recorder. You really don't need to spend a whole lot. I've always told people that an old school recorder is just as good as a digital recorder. I mean, there's a lot of theory behind that, but, you know, any recorder, you know, like those old giant ones you had in grade school, and those are just as good using an exterior mic, just so that the tape doesn't get in.
Yeah,
so you don't hear the tape rolling in the background. But, you know, a good recorder, notepad, notes, and handy cam, any kind of video cam. And really the video cam is two things. It's there to record if any phenomenon happens, but it's also there to document what your investigators are doing in the field, and I think all that ties into documentation is one of the most important. Now, as far as photography, as far as empirical, it's very hard to use, but you know, film is great, and so is digital. The thing is, with digital, people get a lot of orbs and stringy things and stuff like that, and a lot of times it just ends up being the sensor and the digital camera that causes a lot of that kind of stuff. So I like film more than I do digital film, because regular film has a lot less anomalies than digital does.
Yeah, but the other side of that coin, too, I mean, see, there's, and I know you'll agree with this, there's always two sides of the coin. I mean, film cameras, you're going to get a lot less orbs.
Yep.
Digital cameras have the added benefit of EXIF info that helps, doesn't guarantee, but it helps with validation. All right, so you've got a digital or a tape recorder, and just so we're clear for everybody, if you do use any kind of a tape mechanism, use an external mic away from the machine.
Absolutely.
And digital recorders are cheap, too, and the advantage of those is you can upload your stuff much, much
easier.
Now, so, go ahead.
I was going to say there is a difference between digital and not analog, and I had this explained to me by a gentleman out of WVU. He's one of the head engineers for their transit system there, and he's also an amateur inventor. He gets into all different types of paranormal type of phenomenon, but two of the things that impressed me was his knowledge of acoustical engineering or physics and electromagnetics. And dealing with the difference between digital and audio, or digital and analog, is that he says digital is synthesized, meaning it's not true sound when you're actually seeing it. It's recording true sound, but it's interpreting it into a digital signal and then into that format as a flat sound. You can't really actually pull it apart physically as far as true sound. It's actually one sound that you're actually messing with when you actually edit it, and like cool edit and all those things. You're actually not pulling different frequencies out. You're actually manipulating the sound that's already there. Now with analog, he says, you can actually pull frequencies off of analog, because analog being tape or being recorded onto a magnetic tape strip is actually recording and playing back true sound. Maybe not in the greatest quality, or depending on the recorder, but he can actually physically put it into a machine there that he works with at WVU. I guess it's with the physics department, and he can actually run it through the system and extract different frequencies of sound. So let's say you have an EVP, okay? An EVP is a disembodied voice of the actual person, and if you've really done a lot of work to find out if that EVP is what it is, great. You can actually take that apart, and if it's an EVP, meaning if it's a ghost talking, then it's actually, the sound should not be at the same octave as a person's. So he'll be able to find that out by doing these processes. And he says he has, when he's analyzed some of these tapes with EVPs on them, some of these voices actually were located in different frequencies that human voices are not found. And that's what's impressed him about that. But he also says he's not impressed with digital because you can't do anything with it, unfortunately. It's great. It's easy to use in the field, and it's good to have both, really, in my opinion. And, you can verify the noises and sounds, actually, with digital because it's a lot more sensitive. But that's his biggest difference in between analog and digital. Digital, you can work with easy and present it to people easier, but if you really want to find the meat and potatoes, if you really want to get down to it, analog is the best way, especially if you have access to somebody that can do this type of analysis for you.
Right. Okay, so we've got your recorder, got a handy camera, video camera. What
else? Taking, like we talked about earlier.
Taking note, What else would you recommend?
As far as equipment, of course DVRs are getting cheaper. Those are always more handier to use to cover an area, but they're not always applicable.
Right.
I think just the rudimentaries are actually good enough to actually start investigating. With a good background check and doing some historical research, learning how to do that properly is actually one of the most important tools as well, especially behind locations that are known to have hauntings due to either a murder or something that's actually been written in some historical format. And those are usually the best ways to verify types of activity that have been recorded, especially if the people that are seeing these things had no idea about the past.
Right. Okay, so DVR systems are there. They're going to be a little bit more spendy. You can often get a video camera for fairly inexpensively, even used, even digital used, and they're not that bad. What do you think about what's your take on EMF meters?
I do have a few favorites. I do like the tri-fields, but they're very sensitive. So those are really only good for stationary observing. But the tri-field natural EM field meters, which run around $275, $200, depending on the type of model.
Actually,
you
get those for under $200 now.
Oh, yeah. They keep dropping. So. The natural.
Tri-field natural, yeah.
Because you got to remember that EMF, or electromagnetic fields, is actually spread out amongst different frequencies. I mean, it's a huge, it's a huge rainbow of different types of electromagnetic fields, and really a lot of these digital ones, or the really cheap ones, really only detect, you know, really, you know, kind of put it all into one a lot of times, and it could be coming from about any source. So, but the more sensitive, the better, you know, I say, because what you're really looking for is a real subtle change in the dynamic field. You're looking for a dynamic change rather than static. Static can tell you a lot of things, too, which means it's stationary. It never changes.
Right.
And that can tell you, you know, maybe that has an effect on somebody. Yeah, exactly. And, well, for example, at the Clewiston Inn, room 118, you know, and that hallway as well, and some of those rooms had EMFs up to 140, 200 milligusts.
Unbelievable.
And, crazy. And there's been a lot of studies on EMF and what its effects are on people. And some of the leading effects that have been found have actually been visual, meaning, you know, they'll put a person in what's called a fear box that they've actually constructed, where they're bombarding this person with high EMF in this dark room with no sound. You know, it's basically sealed off. And this person's actually observed, you know, seeing their leg crawl up the side of the wall. You know, there's a number of things that can happen with EMF, and especially if you're exposed to it for a long period of time, and especially if you're exposed to it in a dream state, it can probably have a profound effect on your what you see and how you see it. Now, the big issue between that is does the phenomenon feed off of that energy or that EMF field to manifest itself, or does that EM field cause you to see those things? So, you know, it can go either way, really, it's pretty interesting.
Well, Grant does a good program on that, you know, hallucination or apparition. In fact, he's going to be doing that topic at the Paranexus conference in October in Tampa. Grant, you got any comments on that?
Well, you know, Morgan's right on target. There's been a lot of research done on it, of magnetic and mild electrical stimulation of the temporal lobes of folks. And I think Dr. Persinger out of Laurentian University up in Toronto, Canada, has done considerable research. And by stimulating the temporal lobes in some of his experiments, they've determined that of course, everybody's an individual, but they manifest a lot of characteristics that Morgan just alluded to, plus an overwhelming feeling of the presence in the room, coupled with feelings of being watched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's been reported quite often in these tests.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear a lot of that in the field, you know, especially where people don't see anything. I've had a case down here in Fort Myers on McGregor where a gentleman had, you know, he had like three alarm clocks, I guess one for each type of thing. But these were like alarm clocks from the 80s, so they were kind of aged. And on the thermal, they actually picked up red because they're emitting a lot of energy. And they ended up emitting like 140, 160 milligusts.
Wow.
And you know, I said, well, let's try something. You know, let's try removing these from the environment, get some brand new ones, and, you know, see what happens. And so far, the checkups that we've done, he hasn't reported anything else. And he was reporting the typical uneasy feeling, being watched, and sometimes things out of the corner of his eye. So why he's sleeping.
And you know, the thing that's so interesting about it, and I know you guys are going to agree, is that if you have somebody who is being exposed to this, they have no idea they're being exposed to it many times. It's so subtle that
right.
A person would never pick it up and never even suspect that that was what was going on. And it can happen sometimes, too, when people live in close proximity to high power lines.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's a typical environment for that type of field. Now if you know that I think it was in I can't remember the exact year, but it was sometime in the mid 80s and late 90s where they were talking about health safety risks, and this is dealing with my field. They were actually considering having regulations on the amount of EMF, electromagnetic field, emitted by these power lines and cables and systems, and what, you know, in a workplace, OSHA was getting involved, and they just dropped it because they found that it was going to be, well, first they claimed that they didn't find any health effects, which I know eventually if they did a long enough study on it that they would find health effects on it, but they claimed the other part was the business aspect. They would literally have to spend, or companies would have to spend billions of dollars to re-insulate all these wiring across the United States, and they weren't about to get involved in that, and they dropped it, and they never went back to regulating it. And that's why you have, if you go on a professional equipment's .com website, you'll find all these types of EMF data loggers, stuff like that, and they use that specifically for people in the workplace to monitor their exposure. And since then, they just dropped it, but the equipment was still being made, and it's still there available today.
It certainly raises questions in my mind about, you know, if that's true, and we have no reason to doubt it, what about other, you know, type of waves that we're bombarded with, like microwaves?
Exactly.
Cell towers, and, you know, it makes you really wonder, you know, how much of this, you know, at some point down the road, you know, might really be contributing to it. But we know one thing for sure, that without getting on my soapbox, I don't think they're going to come forward and let us know, because
absolutely.
What you talked about, Morgan,
yep.
it's cost prohibitive for them to try to make a change.
Yeah, cost prohibitive, and it'll just put too much light on the regulatory body, and they don't want anybody looking at them, you know, half the time if there's a, especially like with asbestos, if there's a big case and it's dealing with government and another government violating the law, they just tend to try to make it disappear because they don't like everybody looking at them, you know. And I think that was kind of the deal with this EM field issue and health and safety. I mean, I've even had a teacher, and I won't mention the school district, but I've had a teacher during an inspection of mine complain about, you know, tingling sensations, burning sensations, and she said, I asked her where she sat all the time. She was an assistant teacher, and she sat underneath this network box that was right above her head. And I went up to the network box. I just to put my hand on the outside cover, the insulating cover, and it was hot. And I opened it up, and lo and behold, you had a whole, you know, Cat 5 you know, motherboard in there hooked up with all the wiring for the entire school. And I said, well, more than likely it's because you're sitting right under this box and it's you're getting a high EM field here. And I didn't have it with me. I wish I brought it, but just by putting my hand close enough to it, it was emitting a heat signature and you could definitely feel it. And I said, you know, that's more than likely what it does. And that is what EM, high EM fields cause, is irritation, rashes, even in some cases. It's a real true health effect.
Yeah, hallucinations. Okay, so let's just segue a little bit on. Let's take that a little bit further. So for newer groups or groups who are just starting out or who haven't really encountered this, this is definitely something that they have to keep in mind when investigating a location. You know, what's the EMF readings going on? Is there a natural explanation for people seeing things? Right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a number of things that they can go through. Like I said, go to spaceweather.com. Make sure that you see all the different types of environmental situations that are going on in the environment, especially if they're in an outside environment. You know, check the weather. Check, you know, that's why it's always good to have a good, like you were mentioning, different types of equipment. There's a temperature and humidity types of equipment. There's like, you know, Fluke, who makes the thermal cameras. They make an excellent
FLUKE,
F-L-U-K-E, like Fluke, who makes They also make other equipment like thermals. Same with FLIR. Oh. FLIR is also another one, but Fluke also makes
different types of meters myself.
Mm-hmm. And the relative humidity and temperature meter, and it makes sure that it's ambient air temperature right. measurements, because the big misconception that I saw early on was this use of these surface temperature laser pointer temperatures. And people are like, oh, it's a cold spot. Oh, my gosh, there's a cold spot here. And really all they're doing is measuring different surfaces. Like they'll hit a piece of metal, which is going to be significantly cooler than a piece of wood or carpeting.
Right.
And people don't realize that, but they're chasing, you know, cold spots all over the house. And, I haven't used that meter in, since my, a family member bought it for me for Christmas, because I knew then, especially being in my industry, exactly how that thing's used. And it's really only to use is to measure surface temperature. And the best temperature gauge to have is an ambient temperature gauge. It's something that measures the air immediately in front of that meter.
And let's also add that if you do get one, if the groups do get an ambient meter or thermometer, it needs to have instant, what's the word I'm looking for? It needs to be an instant read.
Yeah, they are instantly. Typically they're delayed by a few seconds, but they're typically instant reads. And always be sure to keep it away from your breathing pathways, because you can really affect these types of instruments very easily if you breathe on them, if you sneeze on them, or if you especially if you take it outside and then you take it into an air conditioned location, you're going to get readings off the charts that don't make any sense. So always keep it insulated, like in a sandwich bag or the case that they give it to you, and until you get to the location. So yeah.
Very good. All right, so we're coming up on the bottom of the hour here. We're going to take a break in a moment. We're talking with Morgan Bell of Southwest Florida Paranormal Investigations. A lot of good information. We've got some more things to talk about coming up, too. Please visit Morgan's website. It's abbreviated for Southwest Florida PI, or Paranormal Investigations, SWFPIonline.com. Is that correct, Morgan?
That's correct, yep.
Great. Very good, and we've got some more to talk about. Don't forget, listeners, you can call in, live call in. You can ask Morgan questions. We've only got a half an hour left. So if you have a question you'd like to ask Morgan, it's very simple. There's a number right there on your screen, 347-945-7799. Love to hear from you. Love to get your question, especially if you're newer to the field and you have some questions for Morgan. Please don't hesitate. And you can also join us in the chat room as well. With that, if you'll hang tough with us, we'll be right back, and we will finish up with Morgan Bell.
Sounds good.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Thank you. the sky. It's Paranex's universe. Darkness follows.
Even if they disagree in certain aspects, they'll probably agree with certain things, and those things will end up developing even more. I see that, especially now that we're working with a lot of other groups around Florida, that there's a lot of good development going on between us and other groups, and especially the new groups, which, you know, like yourself, our group, and a few other groups, like Dusty's group, and, you know, a few groups that have been around the Florida Ghost Team, been around for a while. You know, they should, you know, like ourselves, should work with the up-and-coming groups, because a lot of those groups aren't going to go away. But, you know, the more we work with them, the better off they'll represent the community as a whole. You know, because, you know, you allow a group to kind of run, you know, do their own thing. It's fine. You don't want to, you know, do anything with them. But especially if they're really close to you, they end up making a bad mistake, which you could have helped them out with in the beginning, then they end up making you look bad as well in the field. And regardless, because the way the community in general views us is one community rather than a bunch of different groups.
Correct.
And if one group does something really bad, it reflects on everybody in the community. And I think the more we work together, the less we have to worry about that kind of stuff happening.
So what, you know, you can see somewhere down the road, I'm sorry, Doug, where, you know, you could try to almost standardize this, and I think that's where you're going. And I mean, as much as it can be standardized, because the first step is to get that forum where we can share ideas. Like any type of scientific approach is going to do, you're going to welcome the feedback. And, you know, hopefully we can get to that point, and I'm optimistic about it, because with your efforts and our combined efforts, I think we're going to get there, Morgan.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you know, like in any industry, like in my industry, there's standards, there's certifications, and I know I've talked to Doug about certs. You know, I have my hang-ups on it, but he made some good points. You know, the fact that you guys have that cert that has a lot of good information in it. But, of course, there's things in there that I totally disagree with. But, again, at the same time, there's some excellent information. And I think over time, those type of things evolve into a final product that eventually there will be standards. But right now, I think there's just not enough you know, that we've actually found tangible to do that. But I guess as technology improves and as our techniques improve, that stuff will come about eventually.
But, you know, I meant more from the standpoint of, I think a lot of people, our two groups excluded, approach it with, I'm going to grab an EMF meter and a flashlight, and I'm going to go out and catch a bunch of ghosts and my digital camera. And they don't really have any kind of knowledge or working knowledge of the basic scientific approach to looking at a problem. And, and one of the things I admire so much about your group is the fact that you emphasize that. And as you know, in our certification course, we're not saying that, you know, you're going to have a degree in parapsychology.
Right.
What we're trying to do is set that standard to say, look, these are what are known in the field now. Take our knowledge, use this knowledge, and you can say that if nothing else, you have taken a course that's familiarized you with all the basic knowledge that we have at our hands right now, with the pros, the cons, the iffy areas, the gray areas, and take all that into consideration, because any good scientist is going to do that. Right, not too long ago, when you kind of talked about how some groups will attack groups over a philosophical difference in whether they believe in orbs or whether they believe the Ouija board is going to cause something, and you know, it's one of those things where, even we were attacked about a couple months ago, as Doug will, you know, testify to, and people were all angry with us because we sold our book or we sold our certification course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they completely lost sight of the fact that even in academia, people sell DVDs, people sell books. It's the same thing, and I think they kind of confuse it like it's a big profit-making thing.
Right.
We wish it was a big profit-making thing, but you know what?
Right.
It's more about helping people understand the whole field.
Oh, exactly. And you know, when I got to know your guys' approach in that cert, I actually read through a lot of that book, and I'm planning on getting it, actually, is, you know, the fact that you guys do state that. You say, look, this isn't pure fact. This isn't, you know, this is our opinion, this is the stuff that we've learned, and this is stuff we've actually pulled from all over the community to put it into one source, because there really aren't a whole lot of one-source places. But then I also like the fact that you guys tell the people that are getting the cert, you know, don't lean on this. This isn't like, you know, once you get certified, you can go out and do whatever you want, because anybody can become certified. Just like in my industry, anybody can become a mold remediator, but it's not standardized. The government doesn't standardize mold remediation. It doesn't do anything. Anybody who can become a mold remediator and become certified at it. But at the same time, it's the person behind it. It's really the, you know, how they use that knowledge and push forward. So, you know, for somebody to say, look, I'm certified, that doesn't really mean much.
Well, it doesn't mean anything to the paranormal community.
Right.
It means nothing to the paranormal community. But to clients, it means
something.
It adds credibility. You know, even if it's presumed, it still adds credibility. And one of the things, too, that you mentioned earlier on in this interview, Morgan, was that people skills. I was asking, what would you recommend for new groups? People skills.
Right.
And that's I'm with you 1,000% on that one. And that's exactly what that course is all about, people skills. Yes, it talks about equipment and, you know, ghosts, all that stuff. But the emphasis is on us. People, your clients. And I don't want to beat that one to death, but I wanted to ask you, though, on your, because I know it's a mission in your life to help groups to come together and to work together. And I was involved with trying to get us back on, which we are back on. And it should, for those of you who are listening, if you did miss part of it, it should be archived. So if you'll take a look at that, I don't know what happened. It was not on our end. So we all remain connected. But anyway, Morgan, just in case I missed it or whatever, hopefully I'm not being redundant, how can groups work together? What can they do?
Well, you know, there's these types of different conventions that people can attend to at least network and learn and just communicate with each other. But one of the most important things, especially our investigations, you know, really getting to know people is going on investigations with them. And, I, you know, like if you have locations that are very public, much like the Clewiston Inn, or other places like that that allow that type of investigating to go on, it's a good place to bring groups and kind of say, hey, Point Paranormal, you know, out of the East Coast, do you guys want to come out and investigate the Clewiston Inn? We might do it, a joint investigation, or we might just have a few of our representatives there, and you guys can conduct an investigation of this place. You know, and for a new group, I mean, if I remember first starting out in a group, I mean, that would be like, oh my gosh, what an opportunity, you know? And it's kind of like, that's when you get to know people and learn from each other and give a little bit of your knowledge, and they'll give a little bit back, and, you know, and it works out. And then so far, every time we've done that, even with times where the investigation really didn't go well, it was still beneficial in the end. So, you know, it's a learning process, and I think, relationships between groups is also a learning process, and it just takes time, but it needs to start.
Well, there's a huge advantage to just being with like-minded people who are after a similar objective. You know,
right.
It's encouraging and it's strengthening. You know, it kind of helps
yep.
you get your resolve, because a lot of times, you know as well as we do, that you don't get much. And, you know, it can be strenuous and monotonous doing this.
Right. And you'll even have, you know, and you'll be dealing with a lot of groups who, you know, they first start out, I mean, you know, maybe less than a year, 2 months, and they've already bought, you know, thousands of dollars worth of equipment when, you know, really they should have been taking baby steps and really starting to learn what they need and what they don't need and, you know, what fits their criteria, because it is a learning experience. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, you can be overwhelmed with, you know, trying to worry about all the types of equipment or theories and things that you need to know when you could just start out simple and work your way up.
Yes. Okay, so we've talked about equipment. We've talked about things to keep in mind. Speaking of equipment, though, you use a Mannix EMF meter, correct?
Yes, I do. Mannix, M-A-N-N-I-X is how you spell it, makes a data logging version of their EMF detector. Very, very good EMF detector, digital. It actually detects several fields of EMF, EM fields. But and it combines it into one. It doesn't necessarily separate them out. But it data logs, which is, you know, very, very useful. Not very many EMF detectors data log. And these things cost around $200, I think, at the cheapest. I think I've seen them at $180. But, you know, you have other meters like Triaxial, which also makes an EMF data logger. So there's a lot of out there, and I've even talked to the guys at Lasker who make these really neat little, you know, the temperature and humidity data loggers I talked about earlier, little USB units.
Yeah.
Well, there, I actually sent an email to them describing what I do and the fact that it's a huge industry, really, as far as people being involved. And I said, you know, it would be a good idea if you guys developed a small USB EMF data logger, you know, for just overall measurement. And they emailed me back, and they seemed somewhat interested in looking into that further, and they have a planning meeting coming up in April, and they'll get back to me about that and see what they're going to plan on doing. And so, you know, soon we might have a really good, useful tool for measuring over long periods of time EMF fields. So we would be able to attribute this type of activity, if it is, in fact, attributed to EMF, which is hard to do when you just have a handheld and you're just walking around, you know. So over a long period of time, I think it would be better. And I talked about this guy named Jim Brown at a WVU that I was talking about, the amateur inventor. I was talking about how he was talking about analog versus digital. Well, he also was into EMF, but for a different reason. He had actually constructed a EM detection system, triangulation system, where he's able to detect high EM pulses or fields that are created in the atmosphere and below ground. And he had tested this system out up in West Virginia. I think it was West Virginia or Ohio, one of the places around there. But where he actually detected a high explosive test from the Bureau of Mines. He had it triangulated. He had his three systems in different areas set up, and they were recording. And an alert will come across his system where it'll measure the amount and location. And he's actually been able to track exactly where this explosion happened. So he ended up showing up to the Bureau of Mines, And, you know, he went in there, gave him this data sheet, that which gave a location, a, you know, a GPS, or not a GPS, but, you know, a longitude, latitude marker. And lo and behold, the guy looks up at him and said, "How did you do this? I don't understand." And I, and the guy's like, "I have this," he explained it to him. He's like, "I've never heard of that in my entire life." And he was actually able to detect a underground, I think it was 400, 500 feet or something ridiculous, underground test of this type of dynamite that Bureau of Mines is testing.
How far?
And he was about 100 miles away from this location.
Wow.
But he had it set up to where he could triangulate. I guess he had it a few of these devices set up in different locations where they were logging that type of information. Now, the reason why he built this thing, and he's actually done it with other cases, is for the UFO phenomenon. He actually has been able to successfully track, well, high altitude aircraft, but at the same time, he's been able to track, you know, anomalies of high EM fields being emitted by maybe one of these craft, especially since there was a sighting, I guess he attributed it to, of a large craft that was seen, I guess, over West Virginia one evening. And he actually had this thing running still. It's always running. And he actually went back to it to see what it was, and he actually found a location and everything of this high pulse that he recorded. And he was able to triangulate the location of where it was, and not so much, you know, altitude or anything, but he was able to get a longitude latitude. And, you know, it was kind of funny. He said it was just odd how it was the same date and time when these people actually saw this thing. And I actually was able to measure some sort of EM or EM field pulse in that area. And so a lot of this also has a lot to do with our field. Also, he says he's able to make one that can actually measure EM fields within a house or within a location in the house. It doesn't matter, but you can still use them in a similar sense, just in a much smaller area. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk about something else that's similar, same thing, only different. Are you familiar with Frank's Box? Do you have any opinion on it? Do you know anything?
Yeah, Frank's Box is the one with the radio, right? That continuously plays. Yeah, to me, and this is just me going off of what I think of it just by theory. I mean, it's possible, but I think that Frank's Box is more of what the listener is looking for. Let's say if I had Frank's Box and I was asking questions and I was looking for a particular answer subconsciously, I'll find it in those words that are being recorded. If I'm not particularly looking for it, there may be, it just may sound jumbled. So I think it has a lot to do with the user and a lot to do with chance. But, you know, there have been a few really interesting, I guess, results. But at the same time, I still think that it's up to the – it's a user deal. It has a lot to do with human error. And it's like the new term. You've heard of matrixing, correct?
Right.
Well, it's kind of the same, but not exactly. But people are starting to attribute that term to audio as well. Like when people turn a fish tank on, they hear a lot of voices. Well, I think if lots of that is the mind trying to make sense of chaos, and that can be visually and that can be audibly. And I think that Frank's Box has a lot to do with your mind trying to make chaos, you know, or trying to make sense, you know, trying to make order out of chaos. And I think if you're looking for an answer, you're going to hear it in those voices that are coming across the radio.
Well, Morgan, what's the general principle behind Frank's Box?
As far as, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not very familiar with it. I've just heard it in passing, because I haven't really looked at it in general. So this is me assuming. I think that the whole premises was the fact that he's able to use it like a scanner system that goes over different radio signals. And that the premises is that spirits or the dead can actually manipulate it to use the certain phrases that it wants you to hear, as far as manipulating to hear their message, more or less that the entities or spirits are actually in, you know, are in a different dimension, which time really doesn't have an effect on them or doesn't apply. like that does for us linear. I can't talk tonight, but you know.
Sure. No, I just kind of got the impression, I mean, I'm refuting anything you say because that's certainly not my area of expertise.
Right.
But I was under the impression that it's relatively inexpensive to make.
Sure.
And that, you know, it's almost like a Heath kit or a crystal radio set, like back from the old days. But, you know, one of the things I've always wondered about with that, and something that nags me a little bit about EVPs is, with all the radio signals that have gone on and, you know, the way that radio signals bounce around, and if you had some radio signals of very low frequency, they might stay around for a long, long time in the atmosphere. I was just kind of wondering if, you know, like, say, how can we be sure that some of those odd, disjointed messages that sometimes we pick up aren't actually old radio signals that go back on and they've been diffused, they've been intermingled? You know, I mean, it's just food for thought.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely possible. In fact, there's people still picking up signals from World War II coming back into ham radios and stuff like that because they're actually starting to reflect back off of certain objects in space. Which is a typical thing that's always been known to happen. And, you know, like, you know, picking up, you know, random radio traffic from, you know, 10 years ago, it's been known to happen. And with EVPs, especially the few that we've caught in this one location that we've had, you know, it's very possible that these are radio or microwave signals or people, you know, on cell phones or wireless phones, and we're only picking up snippets. I think, you know, the biggest thing that you need to do when you're doing EVP research is that you're looking for something that's reacting to your questions. And you're trying, if it doesn't make any sense, if it doesn't make any sense and it's saying something totally freaking random, then, you know, it should probably be kind of, you know, on the fence at that point. When you kind of look, this is an interesting audio recording that we found, but we can't prove that it's an EMF, an EM. Electromagnetic EVP. Sorry, it's getting late.
Many acronyms, man.
We know what you're talking about, Morgan.
Yeah, Bahamas, man. It's spring break here, you know.
Get
used to it down here, but
it must be rough.
Oh, it's terribly rough.
All right, folks, we're coming up on the end. We got less than 3 minutes to go. Morgan, we've been talking with you about a number of things, some good information on what to do, and especially for newer groups or groups who maybe haven't gotten all the knowledge gaps filled yet. So some good stuff. We really appreciate you coming on. Your website again is?
SWFPIonline.com, and our MySpace is just MySpace/SWFPI. And I mentioned a bunch of sites on here like professionalequipment.com where you guys can look for equipment. The best thing is to find the equipment there and then go find it cheaper somewhere else. I think Asian Wolf.com is a really good site for DVR systems, cameras, and stuff like that. And if you want to learn more about that SMPD chip, you can just go to it's Planet 82. Just Google Planet 82, and in fact, the website is planet82.com. And you know, there's a lot of aspects of equipment that you can learn from those sites that is pretty interesting.
And then if you're in Florida, you guys have got a conference, a little convention going on in St. Petersburg. When is that again?
Yeah, that's June 6th, 7th, and 8th, it's in St. Petersburg at the Heritage Hotel, and it's $128 a night, and that's for the room, not per person. So you fit four people, and you split the cost, and you're good to go. We're trying to make it cheap. So.
Okay, good. So if you're in Florida and you want to do some networking, then that's a great thing, and some educational stuff going on.
Yep, just go to our website for that information and call us, and we can give you guys an authorization code for the hotel. That's all you need to use for registration.
Very good. All right, listeners, we really appreciate you listening. Please visit our website, paranexusradio.org is the new URL. It used to be sgradio.us. You can still get there from there. But the new one is paranexusradio.org. And if you get a chance, also visit paranexus.org for an upcoming conference in Tampa in October. A little top-notch professional conference. We're going to have some great speakers and activities and things like that. So we appreciate everybody listening. We appreciate your time that you spent. Now, next week, we have Spirit Team member Christy Robinson on. She's going to be talking about psychic self-defense and some different ways of looking at. I know you're going to find that program extremely interesting. Christy is a very, very interesting person. We'll look forward to seeing everybody on the program next week. Grant, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Same here, Doug. And Morgan, it's always a pleasure working with your group. And you're true professionals, and we always enjoy talking with you.
Absolutely, guys. See you around.
Okay, folks. Until next time, this is Doug Kelly and Grant Rubin-Dunst on Paranexus Radio. Take care.
Darkness follows.